to Augustine, we're on just war. The idea of just war preceded Augustine, but he's the first one to kind of put it into theological categories. Because he was the great mind that he was, his categories are still being discussed, debated, and considered in both government and in philosophy departments to this day. So you're talking 1,600 years later, ideas that were put forth, people are still wrestling with, pondering, debating, taking issue with. I can't remember what I preached last Sunday. And so the idea that somehow something that someone thought and put down would last 1,600 years is not in Scripture. It's just kind of crazy. So what do you know about just war? What do you think you know about just war? Yes. There are two aspects in Augustine's thinking. Use at bellum, and here he had four. So the just cause, the first one he always cited was just authority. Just cause is the second, right intention is the third, and then the last resort. Those were preconditions in order for a war, a state or a country to go to war, for that war to be just. These conditions had to be met. But then he also had what he called jus in bello, some people say, which we'll talk about later. But these principles, and there were three of them, were about the conduct of war. So this is simply about the right to go to war, and then these ones are about how the war... You could be just in going to war, that end up being fighting an unjust war if it was being fought unjustly. So this first part is just the right to go to war. We'll kind of limit that. So just talk of just authority. Basically, it comes down to a due political process, a legitimate political process had to have been followed. In the United States, there has to be a declaration from Congress for us officially to be at war. Now, we've had all kinds of experiences throughout history. You know, we'll call things a police action as opposed to a war, so we don't have to do those kind of things. Yeah, that's what we do. But that's an example of whatever the process has been set up, that process has to be run through for this war truly to be just. That's what we'll say. The just cause, the way he would say it is, has a wrong been committed that war is a legitimate response? Well, that's a tricky word always, right? Legitimate. But has a wrong been committed that war is a legitimate response? The right intention is the response proportional to the cause? Is the war action limited to righting the wrong and going no further? So if we've been wronged and we're now fighting a country, but, you know, on the way, they have some pretty nice beachside territory that we would like to have. If that's all part of this equation, then it's an unjust thing. So right intention is it has to be in proportion. And then the last resort, every other possible option has legitimately, has there has been given a true attempt to work. And you have to exhaust every possible thing. Now, for the tricky thing when it's not just one person at the top is we end up with differing opinions in have we truly tried everything? Or have we given sanctions enough time? Have we tried giving diplomacy as much opportunity as we could? So those are the four that come up for Augustine in Just War. So thoughts, reactions to that, and then the last one, if none of that comes, the other question I'll have you ruminate on, which of our wars as a country might fit that? Regardless of whether we should think of, whether it's okay for Christians to talk about just war, not just war, just talking about his criteria and which of our wars would fit that. So, questions, comments about this part so far, or ideas about some of our wars that may or may not fit in that category?
I come to appreciate it as a very limiting kind of factor, especially considering how war was often fought in the Middle Ages for very arbitrary reasons. And so it can be seen kind of like an eye for an eye.
Yeah, and that would be Augustine's position in earnest. The vast majority of what he wrote about this was about defensive wars, actually. And one of the philosophical debates that's out there is, does his idea of just war apply to offensive wars? There's only like two places in some of his writings that he even hints at there could be a just offensive war. One of his standards is for that is if a country has been warred upon and its citizens haven't been essentially compensated for the damage done to them, if it hasn't been made right, the damage that has been done to its citizens, those citizens would be, that country would be just in essentially retribution at that point. But the vast majority of what he's saying is defensive war in nature, first of all. Secondly, he would be very, very particular about, to really understand what he's talking about in just war, you have to understand his notions of two cities. So there's the earthly city or the earthly kingdom, and then there's the city of God. And you're either a citizen in one or the other. A lot of us, we understand that we belong to that kingdom, but we live here. We feel like we have two citizenship cards. More or less, that would not be where Augustine was in this. You were in one kingdom, one city, or a different city. This was part of the earthly city. He thought it was dreadful and terrible, but he thought it was, until the Lord returned, inevitable. That it was just an unfortunate reality of the fallen world we lived in. So this kingdom was never something to be kind of chased after, as we do see in the Middle Ages. So just war is going to get reinterpreted around 1000 by Aquinas. And there, he's dealing with the area. By the time we get to Aquinas, we are well into the Crusades. So one of the big differences that we see from Augustine's just war theory to Aquinas' just war theory is that Aquinas is going to make all kinds of room for violence. Here Aquinas would change the second one, the just cause. Aquinas would say, a just cause is required, namely that those who are attacked should be attacked because they deserve it on some fault. So it's a just war if those who are attacked because there is some fault. Well, that just leaves the door wide open. Yeah. They wear purple tennis shoes, you know, and they should be eliminated. So yes, to really get our minds around the gospel, we have to understand he is quite kind of limited It is a limiting principle that he's doing here. Not a, hey, we can come up with reasons to go to war, so let's go to war kind of thing.
So, not growing up in a peace church, so like we're talking about just war in a setting where war is completely unacceptable, and maybe can we understand how some Christians might think there are certain circumstances where it might sneak under the door, and then if you don't grow up in that tradition, it doesn't even come up that Christianity might be opposed to war. War is a terrible thing. But God's people did it regularly all through the Old Testament. And so can you talk about how Aquinas or what's his name? Augustine. How they dealt with, like, the Old Testament. And did they think that that had been just wars, or that that was a time that we had moved away from?
Both of them would see the wars that the Old Testament portrays God being directly involved in as being just. You're kind of almost stuck seeing them that way. And that would be some of the rationale why they would go the directions that they do, is to say, we can't see in Scripture a blanket rejection of this, even from the people of God. And Aquinas is going to get there, not Augustine. For Augustine, this is always a dreadful reality of the fallen world. In Aquinas, I think it's in his second book of the Summa Theologica, at one point he talks about just war as a charitable act. That's a radical departure. Here it's like, this is dreadful. We don't want it that it happens. We realize it. Here are some principles for how people pray in the name of Christ to kind of find their way. Here, Aquinas is going to make a case that it can actually be a good, which would sort of be that thing in the Old Testament. We'd say, this isn't just a dreadful reality of the fallen world, but this has, in some circumstances, could be the right thing to do. And to not do it is a greater wrong.
Well, the simple example of that is Hitler. He's murdering millions of people. If we stop him, millions more won't die. So, in that case, it is a terrible act in that sense. We're stopping a greater harm. It's a terrible to those who are saving, not a terrible to him. Hitler, but that's another matter. Sometimes the only way to stop somebody is to stop them from doing it.
And this is kind of the murky mud puddle of this issue, especially for Christians. One of my faith heroes is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was pre-war an avowed pacifist, and then ends up getting wrapped up into a plot to assassinate Hitler. He starts to write things like, if there's a cart that's out of control and you see it careening towards innocent victims, sometimes what you must do is to shove a stick into the spokes of the cart. And so here's a guy who's a committed pacifist that actually thought about going to study with Gandhi. That's how serious he was about this stuff. But in the reality of Nazi Germany, he was not actively involved, but by all indications seemed to be a knowing participant in an assassination plot against Hitler. There is some theological debate among scholars. I think the most of the evidence does still point in that direction. A British spy, a commando, who was actually from Hungary, escaped, went to Great Britain. He had worked with the French Resistance. He knew how to blow explosives off, and then goes to Great Britain and becomes a commando. He and another person are infiltrating Normandy before the invasion because they've been told that there's a certain kind of new mine that Germany has, where if one is detonated, a series of them go off, not just the one that's detonated. And they wanted to know if this was a reality, because this was going to change completely the invasion plan. He gets caught on the beach and is actually taken to Rommel, a desert rat, who's in charge of the Atlantic Wall. He's the one that Hitler has put in charge of the entire defense of the Atlantic coast against invasion. And they have this conversation that has been recorded and is in the German archives, not the audio, but it's transcribed, but word for word, where they are basically saying, we should be fighting on the same side. And the Brit says, how in the world would that be? Who would our enemy be? And Rommel says, well, Stalin, of course. And so, yeah, there is that those issues. What we have to do is brethren in Christ, in the Baptist, I think, personally, this is not like saying anything from a denominational level, I think we have to acknowledge that this is a lot more fuzzy than we need. I think we have commitments and should have commitments, but the issues, when it becomes a case study and this is real people and real, it ends up being a lot murkier than most of us want it to. So, another example from World War II would be, some of the documents are that we decided to take a southerly route as opposed to go to Berlin because the Russians wanted Berlin. And we were concerned that Hitler was actually going to have a second staging area in the mountains down near the Berchtesgaden Garden. So we went south. They go north. All of the German people were hoping that the British and the French and the Americans were going to get to Berlin before. That didn't happen. So we save a lot of our guys, and we could then and save a lot of Germans by doing this. And that could, so we're fighting this in a just way. But what we're doing is allowing Russia to do what it wants to do, which is brutalize both its own people and the German people. In most of the Russian army at the time, your tanks were the most valuable thing. Everyone else is fighting this battle. The tanks were there to give support and protection to the infantry, but the tanks for Russia were so important that they would have the infantry march out where they thought there might be a minefield to clear the minefield with human bodies so that the tanks would be protected. So let's say for a sake of argument, we fought this, it's a just war, and we fought it justly. Is the other people that we're allied with might not be fighting a just war, might not be fighting it justly. What does that do to our justness if we call them our ally? I mean, just that kind of stuff where it gets, oh, my goodness, where did it get stopped? That's where, for Augustine, he would say, this is a terrible reality. He would say that God's ultimate desire is for people in both cities, the earthly city who are not saved people, and the heavenly city. Both cities, God's desire for all people are to live at peace. Sometimes that peace has to be accomplished in war, he would say. Sometimes it's regrettable that that has to happen. But the goal of even that is peace. But then, you know, what does that look like? I mean, how much is it really peace if you won simply? If a person says uncle because you pinned them to the ground, that's one thing. Or if they simply surrender and acknowledge essentially you're right and we're wrong. Those are two different things that happen there. Other ideas or comments about this part of the just war theory? Can you think of wars that we've fought that would qualify as just wars within American history? Let me get real specific. It's possible. I don't know. I haven't thought this out more than about 35 seconds here. So, it's possible that a person could make an argument that the Civil War was more of a just war than the Revolutionary War. Well, I'm glad to be American, but you're wrong. But
if you removed slavery from the Civil War and the Jews from the Second World War, then they fall off the list as being just wars because they would kind of come to the national heading of if someone asks for your coat, you know, give me your cloak too. And so like, okay, Hitler wants to invade Belgium, so they become Germans. Let's not kill people about that. You know, so unless you have the Jews being massacred, and unless you have slavery that needs to be taken off the table, then you're talking about possessions and who's in charge, and then they really drop on the scale of whether they get to be just or not. And I don't think we actually went to war. Slavery was the topic we were fighting about, but we were fighting about who had the right to make a decision, and slavery was the thing that was on the table. So that's why I think it we fought more over who was in charge than what they decided to do.
I'm with it. So isn't that fun? All of a sudden, this very righteous cause might not be enough to make this a just war. Shall we say we'd rather have slavery? I mean, this is just, you know. And the North would have been happy to say, let's be clear about this, we were fired upon first. We've been working at trying to figure this out and make sure this goes. I'm not saying we work, but I bet it's a convenient reason to go to war that puts something gets fired upon. We don't have to, okay, well, this is now on the defensive. They started, they hit us first one. The other thing that this assumes, which I think is a big assumption, this is about Christian nations, right? Now, at some level, it's not about Christian nations because Augustine is right that this is God's plan for all people, and we all have this sort of sense of justice, what is right and what is wrong. Then just war, that does apply across the board. But really what he's doing here is establishing this within Christian theology and trying to say, basically, for Christian nations. Now, he is post-Constantine, right? He's post-Theodosius II. So the Roman Empire has been a Christian empire. It's now crumbling around them, but it has been a Christian empire. And he's talking about, how does a Christian empire go about doing these things? And a different question comes up is, has there really ever been a truly Christian nation? That was a rhetorical question, but that's okay. I'll take that. I'm not saying that nations, even our own, haven't been kind of founded based upon some profoundly Christian, Judeo-Christian principles. I'm not saying that. But one of the things that I find interesting sometimes in discussions like this at an academic level, friends of mine who would have a similar position on peace and war and kind of want to raise that flag really high, we criticize our own government for its behavior because we're not doing just war. But guess what? You'd be the first people to say that this isn't a Christian nation. So on what basis are you applying these standards of Christian behavior to this nation, which you would say is not a Christian nation? And we don't line up at the local bars and say, you people should act like Christians. We don't do that because they're not Christians. Or the strip clubs, or whatever it is. We don't have that expectation, but we sort of put that on nations when maybe the nations aren't even claiming the name of Christ. If instead of the American flag, it was the Christian flag that was flying over the Capitol building, I think we could say, hey, pay attention. But I'm not sure we even got that because a lot of people claim Christ, but is this a Christian nation? So the whole issue of Christian nationhood comes up with this, too, and how, to what extent the just war ideas even apply. I would agree that the church ought to be prophetic in addressing the powers, without question. But I'm not sure. Was it Christian to celebrate the killing of a Sullivan Bob? That's what it comes down to. So, on the one hand, we can read passages, God takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked. But then there are other passages that seem like, well, he's not his. So, I don't think I said anything, but you can say that. And that's what Augustine is trying to avoid by creating these standards. Is he saying, what he's trying to avoid is the temptation that all nations, all governments always have, is might makes right. If you win, your position is the right one. Your cause is just. Not to keep going back to World War II, but I read accounts of one of the last gunners in the boxes on Normandy Beach. But he was a German who's become a friend of an American who was landing on that beach and was shooting. And they in their reported storytelling, they talk about how both of them were praying to get through this. And yet we're both praying to God to get us through while we are both trying to kill the other person. It's like, what do you do with that? And so everyone feels that their cause is just. The reality of the Civil War is that the people who were being prayed to in the South and the people who were being prayed to in the North, that was supposedly the same Christian God. Is this like a football game that he doesn't actually take sides? Or is he weighing in on one of the sides? And whose side is he weighing in on? And
let's not forget that God is in charge of the nations and who wins and who doesn't win and who gets put up and who doesn't get put up. We don't really. We think we might be in charge of that, but we're not in charge of that at all. So we have to. I don't know that we are wise enough to figure it all out. I think individually we have to listen to what God is telling us to do in the situation as ugly as it is, as we are here in the ugly world full of sin. But God uses both the evil man and the righteous man to rise up and tear down nations to bring about the history that he's fulfilling to bring us to what his will is for the end times. That's what I understand to be from Scripture. I could be really wrong on that, but I'm not capable of figuring out even all of my own motives or in a relationship where I'm struggling. So in a relationship where I'm struggling, I think I'm right. But perhaps I'm being like the kids who say, I got here first. My hand was next to that toy closer than your hand was next to that toy. So, you know, how different are we than the children who rush to be first in line, who take offense at somebody who takes a toy that they were aiming for. We rationalize our own actions, even when they're wrong. We make up a reason why they're right, and then we change the story. We change history. People change history all the time, their own history, because they don't want to face their own guilt. I think we can talk to the cows come home about this stuff, but I just think that we personally are responsible for God for how we respond in these horrible situations. And I think we have to allow them to make different decisions.
I think it is quite possible that various people can find their way in following God in different ways. I think that's what has made maintaining the commitment to peace in the denomination hard post-World War II, is that you had people in the same immediate family, even one would go and one would not say that you couldn't go. Is it possible that they're both right? That they're both following, to the best of their ability, what God is saying. I like my world neater and nice, with clear boundaries in that, but maybe that is the way, and I fear that my comments may cause some to conclude that Paul is not really a Christian. We've already known that, but that's what I said. You know, one of the reasons that we're a part of the Brethren in Christ Church is because of wanting something to be true that at some level I can never quite get to. And because I don't, it's so easy to talk about things that are out there. It's political, it's bigger than me, it's the world. But I always come back to the thought of personal. If someone is about to attack and brutalize my wife or children, will I take that stand and watch and let it happen? Or will I intervene? Now, heaven knows, I don't know. I think I know, but I don't know well. I can't imagine. In school, we always had to go in, when they would have an intruder drill, I had to go in my room, turn the lights off, and lock the door and hide under my desk. I dutifully did that, knowing full well that if an intruder came into that office, I was not going to sit in under my desk. I was going to be out there. I would sooner lose my life than see the secretary lose hers because the weakest person in the building has to face the intruder. That's not fair. So how do we talk about that? Do we all ascribe to the belief that we would not defend our wife and children or others if that meant we have to get someone else out? So, you just added about 2 pounds of dirt to a mud puddle.
I'll add another wrinkle to it. If somebody showed up at the door yelling, "Allahu Akbar," would we machine gun? Would we call the policeman? Knowing that the policeman would shoot him, and knowing that our taxes are paying the policeman, so we will pay the policeman to fill that gap if we won't stop him ourselves. I would stop him. I would do my best to stop him. And as Ed said, if somebody was attacking my wife and my children, my grandchildren, they'd have to deal with me, and I would have to make my peace with God afterwards.
I think he would. I'm pretty confident that he would say that this, that he's primarily talking about states and countries, but this is these are general principles about this interaction and the use of force in some way. I think some of these would have to get reshaped. I don't know that just authority becomes an issue in that moment. You don't have time to figure out who the authority is, to go through process, to deliberate. This is kind of like within 5 seconds, this is over one way or the other kind of a thing. So I think it would not be as clean as it is here, but I think the principle that he's trying to get at is still in play. So is it in proportionality? That would be one of the issues. So is your desire to stop or to kill? And sometimes killing is the only way to stop. But that's not always the case. So that all kinds of things that get really fuzzy. Before we're done, let me just talk about the other one here for a few minutes. So we have proportionality. So this is how I'm trying to do two things at once. Proportionality is his first principle. So this is not only, this is about the fighting of the war, how it goes about, but this also then applies to the individual Christian involved in this war that's supposedly just. So this is at the level where you, let's say you as a soldier feel like you are right to join or have to join, need to, there's still this that kind of gets applied to you. And by proportionality, he would say that the degree of force that's permitted for this to be a just act, it has to be enough to address the just cause, but the other limit, though, it's limited by proportionality, by right intention. So you are right to use as much force as necessary, provided that you don't go, provided that you're not out of proportion with the act that you're either trying to stop or make recompense for. So proportionality is the first one. The next one is discrimination. So never would innocent and non-combatants ever be legitimate targets of use of force and war for this to be a just act. Now, what about collateral damage? That's where it gets very fuzzy. When you know that civilians are going to die, and that's a fact that you weigh in your calculations. But they're certainly not the ones directly intentionally in the crossfire. It can't be who's acted the just in any way. And then he talks about responsibility. And basically, if everything else has gone right, if this is truly a just war, then this person is not responsible. The person who does the acting out of force is not responsible for that act, provided it was within proportionality, provided that it was not putting wrong people in the target, and provided all this other stuff. The person was free from responsibility if everything else is in place. That was where Aquinas would end on that. So, it's tricky stuff. It's tricky, hard waters. So how do we, I blame God for some of this, and it's okay. You have clearly this teaching of Jesus of loving your enemies. All these kind of passages that we can point to that head us in the kind of peacemaking, peace-loving, peace-everything direction. But he had all kinds of opportunities to rail against the powers that be and never takes that opportunity up. The only time he gets close to that is when he admonishes Peter in the garden with the sword. That's the only thing at all about his followers in force, really, that we can point to. But when that centurion comes asking for healing, was it his servant? And he says, let's go. And the soldier says, you don't need to come. Just say the word and he'll be healed. I understand authority. And Jesus says, I've not seen anyone with such faith in all of Judea, basically. He's commending it. He could have said, oh, I'm doing this for you, but you need to quit. And if you really want this, you want to be part of what's going on here, when you get back there and see that this is fine, you're done soldiering. Doesn't say that. And so, this is where we go with the best information that we have, guided by the Holy Spirit to the best extent that we can. I don't like just, well, primarily because I know how easy we can justify certain things. But I do agree with Augustine saying that until Christ returns, let's not kid ourselves, this is going to be part of the reality of human existence. It is the world in which we live. So, Margaret, you say something? We can't see our way at this point anyhow, so go ahead.
When the soldiers came and asked Jesus, what must I do to be saved? He did not say, lay down your weapons. He said, don't take what isn't yours. Or don't take money that doesn't belong to you, that kind of thing. Now, war is horrible. And when we had a Japanese family come to our house and come to our church in Oklahoma City and sit across from our children were the exact same age as their children. And for the first time, I came face to face with, oh my word, they could be killing each other. They could be killing each other. And that's when it touched my heart that war is a horror. I've always believed that it's horrible, but Jesus is what, and they became Christians there. And you know, anyway, so there's a lot of conflict in my soul about this whole thing. And no, I don't think I could just stand and watch my grandchildren being whatever. You know, because and unfortunately, the Lord has to do a whole lot of work because by nature I'm a fighter. Thank God for spiritual warfare. Because that's where I go to. But I think it is. It's very muddy. And I don't think we can point a finger at people, at other brothers and sisters who do go to war and give their lives for war, whether we think it's right or not.
Yeah. Especially when in some way they have been asked by their country to do so. When you're dealing with draft, that's kind of that's another layer to all this entirely, as opposed to kind of like someone volunteering to do whatever they have to do. I like your point that we have principles that we are committed to, and then the trick is how do we live our lives out as best that we can through the Spirit of God in alignment with those principles, realizing that on this side of eternity it's messy at some time. And we bump into this ditch, and then we bump into that ditch, but we're following the Lord. Clearly, He wants us to be peaceable people. Clearly. But what does that mean? Do you have to let this person die so that person isn't killed? Is that what that means? Nagasaki, we drop a bomb. We bring this terrible war to a rushing end, in essence. And in reality, Nagasaki was one of the most Christianized places in Japan. When there's a bomb dropped Sunday morning, we killed more Christians that day than... it is a mess. And we have to be careful acting like it's very easy. Well, all you have to do is X. All you have to do is Y. That might work in a test tube somewhere, but in this messy life, it's much more complicated. You just have to make it look the same thing. Okay.
So can you help me with, because we have a minute. Like when you were listing the second category and the proportionality and the diversity, and I again go back to the Old Testament, and I see the Hebrews commanded to kill every man, woman, and child in a place. And I've heard that explained as the attempt to keep Israel from being contaminated by the neighbors meant that there were no non-combatants, that those men, women, and children would corrupt Israel if they were left alive, and therefore the cause was more important than their lives, and so it was okay to kill all of them. Is that... That's the only explanation I've heard of that, that would seem to fly in the face of, you know, Augustine would say, yeah, that's right, they were combatants because the women would marry a man and bring her up with her, so they weren't innocent.
I think that is a way to go, and I'm not saying it isn't possible that that's the way it works out. Where I fall down, and maybe you've heard this too much, I don't know what's going on there. I'm not prepared to say, as some would say, that picture of God can't truly be what God is like. My wife is one of the most peaceful people that I know. But if I pull into the parking lot for office hours and she's up at the corner just wailing on someone, that is totally outside of my understanding of who she is. Now, what I don't know is that she caught someone trying to steal a kid. But all I see is this. And for me to make huge conclusions about that is an error. So the easiest way is to say, those are bad images of God. We have to ditch them because that's not really how we see God. But Jesus, I'm not in that camp. I want to say, I don't like that. I don't understand how that fits with this God that Jesus shows us. But I understand that there's multiple sides to Rob Douglas. There might be many things going on here that I don't get. the other part is you have to be very careful to understand the diversity of what's happening. Does God say, wipe out the Canaanites? Yes, he does. But there are all kinds of things that happen. So what happens when, what happens to Rahab? Is she required to be killed? No. The fact that they don't kill her, is anyone condemned by God for not having killed her? No. That seems to be a right act. In fact, it seems to be so right that we have what? We have Jesus coming through her lineage. So here's a Canaanite who was supposed to be wiped out. He wasn't wiped out. Early in the Canaanite conquest, they have Joshua. They're winning this. They have Jericho under their belt. Word gets out that they're having all these victories. They're moving along, and some people from another town come and want to make an alliance with him. They say they're from a land far away. The reality is they're just over the hill. They promise us that you're not going to come after us. Joshua says, fine. He finds out later that they've been lying. I think between God's command and this lie in the agreement, he has every right to wipe them out. He honors his word to them. And God never once says, you should have killed them all. So yes, there is this kind of thing, this thing that's going on here, but there's all kinds of other things that speak against that that God doesn't ever say bad to. And so it's too easy to say, it's this. Well, either we just reject that because that's not really how God is, or we have to come up with a way which this makes sense to us. Guess what? God doesn't owe you an explanation to that. At the end of this all, maybe we'll find out, maybe we won't. But he might have his own reasons that are beyond us and our understanding. And I'll be the first to say, I don't see how that picture fits with this picture, but I'm not willing to say that's not a legitimate picture. I think that there's so many different sides to God that we have to be very careful of the images of God that we kind of eject or jettison in some way. I don't want you to have a flat view of God, Douglas. I've got all kinds of parts of me. And I think God is like that. So that's where I am. I think those kind of explanations can hold some water, but that's not what I'd retreat. I want to say there's something happened here that I'm ready to say I don't know what that is. And it's complicated. But I'm not going to say that's something that just needs to come out. We got one more week of my ranting, so